Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's book club, we talked to author Ben Rothenberg about his new book, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. Today is the 10th of January, and we're here to sit down with Ben Rothenberg. Ben is not only an author, he's a sports writer, the host of the No Challenges Remaining podcast, and a tennis Twitter superstar. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
What did you make of the tennis Twitter superstar? Is that a badge of honor for you?
I think so. I mean, superstar feels like an entirely positive term, right? So I don't know how sarcastic it's supposed to be, but it sounds nice.
Definitely not sarcastic. Just because I'm British, it does not mean that everything will be laden with sarcasm. But I did put that as the third aspect in terms of the many feathers to your bow, Ben. But I was going to say good morning. It's not good morning. You're down under in Australia, I believe.
Yeah, we're meeting somewhere in the middle. It's like good early afternoon, just for neither of us. Yeah, it's like 6 p.m. here currently. So it's still light out, which is nice. I just left the Northern Hemisphere in D.C., obviously, where sun sets at like 5:15 p.m. now. So that's pretty depressing. So getting to be somewhere where there's more sunshine is definitely good for my mood and mental health.
And it's good for the tennis as well, because it hasn't been fantastic weather. So it's good the weather is good down under today, because the qualifiers have started in Australia. Are you gearing up for the Australian Open?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. First Sunday start. Also, here's a new thing for this Australian Open this year. It's always been a Monday in the past. So that'll be different. I know there's some grumbling among people who have to work an extra day and don't get an extra day off. But I think for fans personally, I think it's great that there's more weekend tennis and people are home from work and get to watch the Grand Slam. I think for fans, it's an entirely good thing. So I will quietly support it among everyone else's grumbling. I think it's always been goofy for Grand Slams to start on Monday morning, or most tournaments to start on Monday mornings. Like, who does that? Like, just start on a Friday night or a Saturday or something where people are actually going to be geared up for some fun recreational event in their towns.
Yeah, and it's kind of starting a bit earlier this year as well in terms of some of the exhibitions that have been on show. I know we had sort of Kyrgios Djokovic was last year, where they kind of tried that practice match format, and then one of the few matches that he played. And then now this year, we were going to have Osaka Raducanu, and I was very excited that I didn't know how that went. But actually, both of them pulled out of that. So it's almost like we're waiting for it to start to see how they're going to be playing.
Yeah, both pulling out. That match completely fell apart. I was planning on going to that match and looking forward to it. And actually, I was going to bring some of my people from my publishing office in Melbourne here who were going to go see Naomi, because it's a book about Naomi and everyone's excited about Naomi currently. So, and then then she pulled out, and then Raducanu pulled out, and then we got refunds. So
yeah. Well, that wasn't the order I thought they'd pull out, in fairness. And we did talk about that on Monday on our podcast, that we thought maybe Raducanu would be most likely to pull out of that one. But you have mentioned this book is about Naomi Osaka, believe it or not, from the introduction. And we will talk a little bit more, obviously, about that. But how does it feel to have the book out? It's been a long time coming. It launched yesterday, I believe. It's got to feel good.
It feels good. And honestly, the best part about it is doing things like this, to flatter you right away. Just the hearing people who've read the book, because for so long, I was just sort of typing into a void of this enormous Word document and just sort of not getting a ton of feedback, you know, from the world about it writ large. So I'm used to doing newspaper writing where you put things out and you know it's getting read pretty quickly. And so this was a different sort of metabolism for this kind of project, to do something this big. So even just, you know, the handful of people who got advanced copies, and I probably talked to still, you know, probably only about a dozen or 15 people at this point who've read the book so far, but just hearing their reactions and their enthusiasm for it, and everyone's been really positive about it so far, which has been great. So you can break that streak if you want, but
I was going to say, so Ben, we invited you on to tell you just how awful the book is. No, we absolutely loved it. We thought it was brilliant. I think there's so much to unpack in the story, and so many things that I wasn't aware of as someone who isn't tennis. And that's why I think it's great to get the opportunity to kind of delve into some of these themes in a bit more detail, and then encourage people to pick up the book, because there is so much in there, and it is such a unique story. And even aspects of the story where, you know, there are parallels, which we'll talk about with Serena Williams. It is very unique to have someone who's almost literally trying to emulate that sort of success and that sort of model. So fascinating as a topic, her kind of whole journey. But in terms of what kind of inspired you to write the book, and when this project started, and how it kind of changed, I think that's kind of something we'd love to know more about, kind of the subject as well as the process.
Yeah, sure. So I had wanted to write a book about tennis for a while, and probably women's tennis specifically, because I covered that a lot and felt like the stories of it hadn't really been told, and why it was such a successful sport compared to a lot of other women's sports. And I wanted to do something more general about women's tennis as sort of as a phenomenon. But then I got some feedback that they wanted something that was a little more focused than doing a sort of sport-wide book, to have something about a fewer number of characters. Anyway, so I had that idea, and that was a bit on a back burner for a while. And then during, I guess, around August 2020, I was really struck by Naomi's development into being this sudden activist and finding her voice. This is in the subtitle of the book. I mean, it's really right there. Just the way she transformed from being this incredibly shy person and this incredibly reticent person, and to becoming someone who was really becoming powerful and disruptive and vocal and finding her voice and speaking out on issues she cared about and affecting change and, you know, stopping the entire tournament in its tracks single-handedly. In that Cincinnati tournament that was in the bubble in 2020 in New York. So that was the moment that kind of I was, and then she won the US Open also on top of that. So I had the idea actually that very day that play was stopped in Cincinnati, and then that she won the US Open wearing the mask too, and sort of called her shot and like embraced this pressure and invited this scrutiny and attention, and then lived up to it and won a Grand Slam. I had never seen anything like that. I think it still remains probably the most compelling and remarkable Grand Slam run I've ever seen anyone do, just in terms of the intangible stuff going, you know, on court. Not that all the matches were huge epics, but just in terms of the meaning of the tournament, I think it still remains, it's probably singular in my mind. So that made me really interested in her, and I started looking into her, you know, just doing sort of, honestly, a lot of like Google really deep dives into a lot of her early life and things like that, and talking to some people, and realized just how much of the story had not been told, like how there really was this void in a lot of the reporting and knowledge about her and her family. You know, and a couple of the things I did find in my early digging were super fascinating and incongruous sometimes, and I was trying to make it all make sense. And so that got me interested. You know, time went on. She wins another Grand Slam, her fourth at the Australian Open the next year for 2021 Australian Open. And then she has the French Open standoff and talks about mental health and steps back, and she becomes this huge lightning rod, polarizing person yet again. But this time it's really more focused on her and starts all these conversations. She gets picked to be the torch lighter in the Tokyo Olympics opening ceremony that August of 2021. And at this point, I was saying to my like literary agent, I was like, come on, this has to work. Like, she's such, how can we not like, make this work
a book about for this book? Yeah.
Well, that I didn't read this that way yet. But just knowing like people care about her, like she's such a singularly fascinating person, and she has the world's attention right now. Like, this has to be someone who we can convince publishers is worth doing a book about, was really the issue. Cause that's the other part of the equation with a book. And obviously for any story writer, for a newspaper, you have to get the editor to agree to run it, but sort of the leap of faith that is required from a publishing company to do a whole book, that's something that's probably a little bit more, needs more convincing, especially for a first time author like myself. So I was just saying, like, Naomi said it has to be able to work. And then, yeah, a couple months later, I got the deal to do it. And with Dutton in the US, who's imprint of Penguin Random House. And so that's been great. And then, so that was around November 2021. And then, yeah, I've been working on the book for, I guess, a little under 2 years really to write it, and spent the first year to get into process. I think you asked about too, but I spent the first year really planning on just shadowing Naomi was the main reporting plan, and going everywhere she was on tour in 2022. And that had some highlights for sure. And that had some benefits, but also as that year wore on, her year just became increasingly directionless, and her tennis was some of the worst it's been, honestly, in years. And her ranking slipped, and she wasn't playing with much motivation. She said, you know, she said actually this month in Brisbane, she admitted she was contemplating retirement a bit at the end of that season, just not really feeling any sort of direction. That was very apparent to someone, obviously, following her closely the way I was, and within her team too. People were not sure where she was going or what her future might hold in the sport. So as someone tasked with writing a book that had to have an ending about where to sort of leave off her career, it was a very uncomfortable moment trying to, just, I was like, I don't know what to do.
We were having
conversations about how to try to figure out how to end the book there. But then, yeah, but then we had this news that was a blessing for her and for the book, honestly, of her having this baby. And also her pregnancy really inspiring her to redouble her efforts into the sport and recommit and find this new purpose and drive for it. So it's this really, I think, natural stopping point for this chapter, this act one of her life, this sort of first major book about Naomi Osaka. And who knows if there'll be more in the future, but by myself or probably someone else, I might do the next one. But I think that definitely made it a much tighter book with a clearer ending. And and also the way that she's come back on schedule and playing again this year, I think makes people really naturally interested in her as well. Like, as I'm having this book come out in the world, I think there's already people who want to know more about Naomi, to talk about Naomi, read about Naomi, write about Naomi, watch Naomi. So all those things have worked out incredibly well for timing. So I am grateful to the universe for making that all happen.
Yeah, it all worked out. And I think that's something where it's so nice that although this is kind of the first part, this is a new start as well for Naomi. And I think that's so nice that no matter kind of what is in the book from the content perspective, there is more to the journey. And I think that's something that's so nice that this isn't necessarily like a retrospective of her career. It's not necessarily the final ending for her. And I think in terms of what we talked about, it won't be the ending because Naomi is such a force around the world in business, in terms of activism. So that's something that I think also kind of means that whatever you're looking at it from, it is kind of the start of a new journey. I was going to ask you though, you said kind of there were things that surprised you in the beginning of your research and kind of in the process, what was the most sort of surprising thing that you found out or the thing that surprised you most about Naomi when you were writing the book?
One of the small things that comes to mind for that question is pretty early on, I found her dad's movies that he made. He was like an independent film director and made three, I think, I don't know if he completed the third one, but yeah, there's three basically titles and movies that he has in his trailers for. And Naomi and Mari acted in one of them. It's called Selfish Love. And I found a Haitian like used DVD website that bought a copy of it and got a copy of the DVD in the mail and watched it. It was really remarkable to see Naomi as a child, as like a child actress on screen. It was this complete part of her life that I had no idea existed really before. I'd known that he was like a videographer, that he did some filming. He made like a highlight reel for her tennis. I'd seen that before when she first came on tour, actually. Those clips of her playing tennis and kind of with like, you know, semi-fancy animations and transitions between them. So it was like somewhat professionally done, but didn't know that he had this whole sort of independent film auteur, if you want to call it that. I don't think he would use that word, but these stories he was telling and making these movies. And I mean, the second separate passion project alongside this already very encompassing tennis project. And the movie's not a big part of the book, obviously. I think it takes a few pages in one of the early chapters, but still just finding that, I was like, I'm fascinated by this. I want to know more about it and try to understand where it might fit into anything. And the other thing is the movie's very dark too. Mm. It's like, it's a very intense movie. It's not like a fun home movie at all. Mm. It's like a very, and all of his movies are about sort of self-destructiveness and violence. And they can be very darkly toned. So seeing that and that was just an interesting sort of thing I found very early. That's the main thing I can think of that I found just from Google initially really, and was so struck by.
Yeah, I think
advanced Google, but Google. Yeah.
She said that she kind of get advanced Google. Yeah. I definitely need to find that advanced Google, but no, I think she said that she was, she still gets tagged in it sometimes. Like she said at different stages in the book. And I think you mentioned that, but if you're looking for like a light watch, you wouldn't recommend it.
No, I would not.
Okay.
It's interesting. It's Naomi and her sister both look like cute and adorable. They're like, I don't know, like 8, 9 years old when this movie's made. So it's cool from a whole movie kind of point that way, but the actual like plot and substance of the movie is definitely very, very grim and not, doesn't end on, spoiler, does not end on an up note or anything.
Okay. So maybe I won't be watching that for some casual relaxation, but in terms of what surprised me from reading the book, and I have kind of mentioned this to you, is that it's this, the young days of Naomi. I didn't realize there was this parallel with the Williams sister story. And, you know, there is this story that you talk about of the parents' struggle, sacrifice. It is a tale of two sisters in many ways, trained by a parent with the goal of becoming Grand Slam champions. Was this something that you're always aware of, that there was this sort of parallel with the Williams sisters? And kind of how did you come about wanting to explain that story?
Naomi talked a lot about her love is the word she uses for Serena, that she really admires Serena so much. And Serena has been such a driving force in her life. And she puts her in a category with, you know, like Rihanna and Beyonce. And she just says someone she has on sort of her personal Mount Rushmore and just sort of a guiding force in her life. And so I'd known about that. But I had not really necessarily known how much the Osakas were really looking at the Williamses and really trying to find a blueprint that they could follow. There's one line from Naomi's mom where her mom, Tamaki, describes the Williamses as sort of being the car driving ahead of them on a foggy night. And so all they can do when they don't know where to go is just sort of follow the taillights of the car in front of them through the fog and obscurity.
It's a beautiful metaphor, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, nice way of putting it. And really, there was this sort of blind following of, well, the Williamses were in the U.S., so we should go to the U.S. And, well, the Williamses went to Florida, so we should go to Florida. You know, they had their father coaching their two daughters to play, so our father, you know, we should do that too. That was a lot of what their story was based around. And there were a lot of differences, and that was this dream that they kind of went all in on in terms of a, you know, gambling sense, like really saying, this is it, this is going to be our path, and really uprooting and radically committing their lives to this path, which was very intense and very isolating for the girls, especially in their childhoods a lot of times, because they got yanked out of regular schools and to go to just the tennis courts all day and then doing some online school in the afternoons and evenings. And yeah, it was a very stark life choice they made, and with the Williamses as the sort of target, you know, the model to aim for.
Yeah, and that was a quote from Naomi's father where he basically said, and this was reported, I think, in 2018 and included in the book, that the blueprint was already there. I just had to follow it. And that's something that I'd never seen it been spoken about that brazenly. I knew, as you said, that she was a real idol for Naomi. But in terms of literally almost trying to emulate and make decisions based on that was something that kind of I hadn't had appreciation for. But do you think that kind of it's a case that imitation's kind of the highest form of flattery? Or do you think it sort of takes the shine off the story if someone's trying to, you know, right, I'm going to try and do this because this happened, rather than kind of blazing your own trail early on?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess if you're saying sort of, is it just trite and unoriginal or something is what you're saying to do it this way?
Kind of, but I just think for me, it's like what we were trying to do was do what they did, you know, rather than like they're my idol and it's a loose term. No, this is like I'm trying to be you a little bit, if that makes sense.
There were differences. I mean, in terms of choices, some were choices and some weren't. I mean, the Williamses got so much more hype and attention as kids, and Venus Williams is on the front page of the New York Times, I think, when she was 10 years old. And because she'd been playing really well in youth tournaments in California, she was, you know, a black girl already making big waves from Compton, already making big waves in a very white scene. And her father was talking a big game about how great she was going to be. And there's all this agent and you know, interest from agents and business and sponsors, all this stuff when she was already a real child. And by the time she finally made her pro tour debut at 14, it was so hugely hotly anticipated. And the King Richard movie tells a lot of this, although I don't think they necessarily do justice to how, maybe they do. I haven't seen it in a while, actually, but in terms of how intense the hype was and how much that was a part of their lives. The Osakas, on their hand, were completely obscure and no one really, they were under the radar, they were off the radar. And a bit because they're between two countries, you know, representing Japan, but not living in Japan, living in the U.S., but not representing the U.S., they, you know, were floundering in some obscurity. And it really wasn't until Naomi had a couple of big wins, at first, you know, getting an agent by beating Belinda Bencic at a 2013 ITF event. And Bencic was one of the be-all, end-all juniors in her generation. And so that Naomi, who was a little bit younger, beat her, caught the eye of her first agent. And then that match against Samantha Stosur that she won when she was ranked outside the top 400 in Stanford in 2014. Those sort of two events, those really outlier great results in her early career, kind of got her on the radar. But Stosur, you know, was saying, other tournaments were saying, or other players were saying, like, they would Google Naomi and nothing would come up. They just didn't know. There was no buzz. There was no attention. There were, you know, nothing to know about her. And Stosur says, when I talked to her about it, she was funny. She said that Naomi, you know, she just saw the name Naomi Osaka JPN on the draw. And it's like, oh, it's going to be some, you know, typical small Japanese girl. Like, I played lots of
not the case. Kind of
make your own national stereotypes, you know. And she said, like, she's like, oh, you know, if you play, like, I forget what exactly she said, like, Americans have big serves and, like, Czechs have good backhands, whatever it was. And she's like, okay, Japanese player. Okay, I know how to kind of basically prepare for this. And then Naomi walked out there being 5'11" and bombing serves. And so her was not expecting that. So that
she feels better about that loss now, though, I think she said. I think I would too.
Aged well, that loss.
Yeah, it has. I think that's such a good distinction, because they did come from obscurity, but they did try and emulate. So that was the surprise packet that they had, obviously, and kind of no one was expecting it for quite a while. And there wasn't success kind of immediately, whereas obviously, as you say, Venus almost was unbeaten as a junior for a period of time before she then made her adult debut on the tour. So that is definitely a difference. But I guess it's a similarity is that kind of the younger sibling sort of became the better player, which was not necessarily what coaches thought at the time of either the Osakas or the Williams sisters. And firstly, I want to ask, are you a younger sibling? Do you have siblings? And do you think that we, as a younger sibling myself, are we just more ruthless in our drive to succeed?
I'm an older sibling, and I definitely think that the young ones are the more ruthless ones. And that's sort of borne out in lots of different studies. And it's interesting, you know, there was like a quote study in that chapter on sort of the sibling dynamic between the two of them about lots of different reasons why younger siblings do better in sports a lot of times. Mm. Just, you can look at data, like there's a lot of data from baseball, for example, probably not a sport you're especially familiar with, but like they do stats that the younger brothers, if two brothers make it to the Major League Baseball, that the younger one tends to have a longer career, be more successful, and also be like a more statistically daring player. Like we'll try to steal more bases, try to take like higher risk plays and just be sort of a more adventurous, rebellious person, which I think is borne out in a lot of sort of younger sibling archetypes a lot of times. So yeah, I definitely think Naomi and Mari had that. The different, the Williams is obviously, as much as Serena had a better career than Venus, they both got the number one.
They're both incredible
lock Hall of Famers. Venus is probably the second, or probably the second best player of the 21st century behind Serena. So they're much closer. The delta between Mari and Naomi was considerably bigger and more typical for tennis siblings. I mean, the Williams is both being amazing. That's the rare story. The more typical story is that a lot of kids in a family try to play tennis, and maybe most of the time none of them make it, but sometimes only one will make it. And
things like the Clijsters.
I talk about this.
Was an example.
Yeah. There's so many. I actually had a long list at some point. I was going to do like a tape early on. Right. I made like a list of like all the sort of obscure siblings. And Elke Clijsters was one of them.
I didn't
even
know that. It was like the list of most wild cards or something. I saw that on. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And they do wild cards too. So there's a chapter in the book about Mari. With Mari, the sort of one major moment of nepotism that Mari got was in the 2019 Miami tournament, where Mari got a wild card and she was ranked in the around 330 or so in the world. And she got a wild card into the main draw of Miami. If it had just been qualifying, I think she may not have raised so much eyebrows, but the main draw was considered pretty audacious and Mari never played WTA main draw before. This is like a big prestigious tournament. But that's more typical. I did a story about Mari for the New York Times at that tournament. And so I was talking to, and it's quoted in the book, I talked to like Novak Djokovic, who was number one of the men's back then as he is now. And he had two younger brothers who both played pro tennis. And actually neither of them did anywhere near as well as Mari. I mean, I think Marco, I could pull this up, Marco got to like 500 something, like high 500s, I think, in the rankings. And Georgie was well to the top 1,000. I never got
there's
to be
so much talk about
sure.
that at the time. I remember it was Novak Djokovic came along. They said there's two more and they're even better. Not quite the case in the Djokovic story. It didn't happen that way.
No, they were not. But that's normal, you know. And actually the same thing. I actually remember that about Serena. I've told Serena this. Like I have, you know, I remember when watching the first time I watched Williams was watching Venus make the final of the U.S. Open in 1999 as a 17-year-old. I remember Serena being in the stands wearing the beads too in her hair and really going wild and clapping and having the best time watching her sister make the US Open final. And the commentator's like, oh yeah, there's a sister. She also plays. She plays too. It was a complete afterthought, Serena.
It's mad. I remember I was relatively young at the time. And I remember that coming out. It was always kind of like this undercut. She's not the tennis player of the two of them sort of thing was almost the narrative. No. When you look back, it's genuinely crazy. And obviously maybe it added to the fire in that sense. But I guess that was one thing that I found quite interesting, because from an outward perspective with Naomi, you see her as being kind of quite humble at times and very kind of, can be very shy and not necessarily completely kind of uncompromising in what she says. And when she talked about her biggest victory, it was actually kind of against her sister. And she was like, it meant I could say every day, ha, I beat you sort of thing. And I was like, you can see her saying that in the Naomi sort of way. But at the same time, I thought maybe they'd be like, out of respect, they don't play each other or she wouldn't celebrate that. But it's kind of the opposite, which is kind of at odds to some of the ways that I've perceived her in the past.
Yeah, and that was one of the first, when I wasn't in Stanford, I was in Washington at their concurrent tournaments, the same week I live in Washington. And so my friend and NCR co-host Courtney Nguyen was in the Stanford press room and was immediately so shocked by Naomi saying that in her very first press conference, like she just beat Sam Stosur, And we just talked about that. And they asked her, like, is this the best win of your life? Like, obviously, like, being like, of course it is. And she's like, no, my best win was when I beat my sister, because I get to, like,
the headline had been written
every day.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that was already, she had that kind of combativeness and spark and fire. And this was just so different. Also, to bring it back to the Williamses, Venus and Serena never did that. There was never any, like, playful trash talk about their tennis. Like, they never seemed to get more up for playing their sister. It was always the opposite. It was always like a deflating experience. They didn't enjoy it. It wasn't, you know,
incredibly respectful of each other as well.
It wasn't what they were there for. And I think I have a line in the book, like, you know, even like in King Richard, the movie that was the Williams family produced movie about their lives, they never sort of had this obvious note of being like, you two are gonna have to play each other. Like, you're gonna get in each other's way. That was a note which is a huge part of Williams' story, especially for Venus, honestly, with how it all worked out. But they never really hit that note in the movie, which I thought was interesting. Whereas the Osakas were all like, boom, 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 like rivalry against each other. It was very, very intense. And Naomi was so driven as a younger player by wanting to beat Mari. And that was what made her want to improve, was wanting to beat Mari. And it wound up being this really, really important motivation and measuring stick for her that made her get a lot better in the end.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that kind of leads to is that that's kind of obviously how she introduced herself in many ways to the world, with those kind of the very unconventional answer at a press conference. And I think that's something where kind of being, you talk about it a lot in the book, being a child of the internet, but also being someone who is taking an unconventional approach to how they do talk to the press and how they do kind of manage their career and their experiences. Have you seen her kind of change over time and in that respect, and how her press conference shifted? Did she always remain as brazen in that experience for you? And what was it about her that's kind of kept people so kind of fascinated in the press room with her answers?
But she's always been, I think she's always been remarkably authentic and honest and unfiltered and uncliched and engaged in this way in press conferences. It's super unique and honestly made the book really easy to write a lot of times, because she was such a reliable, open narrator of her life as it was going along. And there's all these transcripts, you know, she did a lot of press over the years. And she, yeah, there would be, you know, there'd so often be one or two lines in there. It was just sort of, as I was going, I had a whole printout of like every single transcript she ever did. And there'd be a few lines that would come occasionally, like once a tournament or something, that would just like sort of stop me in my tracks. And she'd say something really like profound or about something that happened earlier or whatever, and just piecing it all together in this book. There was a lot to work with, even asking her new questions, but even just the stuff she'd already said was already really, really informative and illuminating. And she was a real natural, and she is real. She, in that moment, was a real natural in that format. And she was one of reporters who covered her, including people because of her reputation. And she was a real like hipster kind of darling in the early days on tour, in terms of like the press room, people like who were sort of nerdier about it and had time and were enthusiasm for covering more obscure players who weren't really title contenders would go to Naomi press conferences, and also like stay for the Japanese part was the secret part too, because she would answer in English. So like the cool kids knew to stay seated because other reporters would leave, and it's like, okay, now Japanese. And usually when they switch to a foreign language at a press conference,
we all bounce. Yeah, exactly.
Get up and leave, which is normal. But
I've sat through some Norwegian ones by accident, and I'm like, not sure I'm getting too much of this one.
But with Naomi, the cool one sort of, the cool kids, as we call ourselves, very, very humbly and sarcastically, we knew to like stick around, and because she also, you know, you get basically double the press conference with Naomi, and there'd be new stuff, and you could almost always tell what the question was based on the context of how she answered it. So that was something there. But then at the same time, skip ahead, you know, I think a lot of that openness and authenticity and vulnerability time, and, you know, the way that she actually processed and engaged and felt everything with a sort of open mind and open heart in a press conference, when things got more uncomfortable for her, that made it feel like a much more perilous place for her sort of emotionally and for mental health. And so that was something that, as she started, you know, sort of straining under the pressure in 2021, she's identified press conferences as something she wanted to use to stop, to mitigate that pressure. And part of that also, as she talks about in the book, was like a lot of sort of classic pandemic era things, like doing a press conference over Zoom rather than have people in the room. And that made her feel more dehumanized as an experience, more dehumanizing as an experience. And then also the dynamic changed a lot actually too, especially for a headline grabber like her, because anyone could pop into her press conferences from anywhere in the world, and it no longer had to be, or not anyone, but any sort of approved media could come in, and there wound up being a lot of, tabloids and sort of websites that were looking to do more sort of churny, clicky content that were suddenly coming to Naomi and asking her more controversial, potentially, or trickier questions, or more
less generous
questions
and
that they
kind.
Thought we're getting.
Right. I think that's
I'm trying to be generous.
I think sometimes she kind of answers what she wants to answer rather than the question. She kind of has something on her mind, mm-hmm. and she'll be asked a question and she'll be exactly. like, you know what, guys? And then she'll just say something. And I think that obviously doesn't lend itself to like a quick, right, next Zoom answer, next answer, give them what they want really quickly when you are someone who does take the time to give you something that you can write about. So I think that was something that was also very kind of interesting in the book. As you said, she identified the press conferences as being a problem for her and from a confidence perspective on Clay especially. And being a journalist yourself and that whole incident in Paris, and she talked about it, kind of maybe mishandled it slightly herself, but at the same time, it didn't necessarily always paint kind of journalists in the best light. What's your take on how that kind of works in that relationship with the media at the time and where it is now?
Where that happened, I think the sort of core people I talked about who've been in her press conferences for years have been kind of the main people, myself and Courtney and Rima Baleo and Simona Cariol. There's a few kind of names people will know who've been kind of the more on the Naomi beat regularly for time. I think we were all really surprised, and we were definitely caught off guard by her statement, which came seemingly out of nowhere for us, honestly, because she had not really, there hadn't been a clear moment. Like, I've been in some tense press conferences. Like, there are players with some national press. I'll actually say one of the main ones come to mind is Joanna Konta had this like really frosty relationship with the British press. And it was like really just like cringy and just like, comfortable and like, oh God, this is like, just like tense. And she did not really get along with them. It was just not, they never vibed. They never like kind of got on the same wavelength, Konta and the British press core writ large. They just were at odds. It was uncomfortable throughout. And I do think that players set a lot of their own tone in press. I do actually think that every player is different. Every player has their own kind of vibe. And even you could probably get that on YouTube even too, but certainly being in the room, like you could definitely, there's a different vibe and different, Roger Federer sits down and has an air about him, and it's different than the air that Serena has. And it's different than the air that Nadal has. And it's different than the air that Osaka has. It's different than the air that Djokovic has. It's different than the air that Andy Murray has. Different than the air than Sharapova. Different than Wozniacki. They all have their own, some of the biggest stars, they all have kind of their own vibe and presence. And they really do, I think they underestimate how much they set the tone, actually. Or some of them do underestimate how much they set the tone. I almost completely forget where I was going with that, but
it doesn't matter.
Go ahead.
There you go. I was saying in terms of the aspects around that, in terms of the press, I think you can see the dynamic being something that can lead you to even become more aware of maybe some insecurities that you had before, especially going into, a surface that she didn't feel particularly comfortable with. And maybe it was, you know what, this wouldn't be something that would be helpful to me. And that's the tricky thing. It isn't helpful to people's confidence. It isn't necessary. People aren't in that room to always build you up. And so you can
and
understand.
It's also just like feeling a loss of control. I do think that all the things I was saying previously about players in the tone, I think a lot of that tone control weakened during the pandemic for every player. I think every player just kind of became another square on your Zoom window on your laptop, and you... When Roger Federer sits down in a Zoom call with you, which did happen for me, like it's less like, oh wow, that's Roger Federer, than it is for him. I'm just using him as an example, but like I remember specifically with him being on at least one Zoom with him, and just it being feeling different. Like it's not like, because usually people are like, Federer got the biggest past tense now, like sort of like fan reactions from a lot of reporters on tour. A lot of potentially like more part-time reporters usually in tennis, we're always like, oh my god, and his rooms are always fuller, and just like people wanted to see him, and he was an event in a way that other players don't get. So that kind of changed that aura and that projection, that sort of control weakened for players in the pandemic. And Naomi was not feeling great about her tennis on clay. She had some bad results, and there's also this other pressure building up for her, more sponsors than ever, more money than ever. More money, more problems, as they say. And also the
also
Tokyo Olympics
success. She's a very successful woman at this point.
You
have to have people ask you some sometimes not great questions, and questions that other successful people don't have to answer to, right?
Well this is the sort of question of like that she would sort of challenge or balked at, and she got into back and forth with Billie Jean King actually in a video. I quote this, and they did a panel together a couple months after the standoff, basically Billy saying, like, or Naomi asking Billy, like, do you think that we owe people like parts of our time and mind and attention because we get paid a lot of money? And Billy was like, yes, you
yeah,
do.
She was very vocal.
And Naomi didn't want to, didn't that didn't gel with Naomi's sort of thought, or certainly not people have been telling Naomi, or what she had decided herself, or whatever her conclusions were. And Billy being more old school, there's this real clash. And you know, there's this sort of, this act happened probably like act four of the book roughly, where, you know, Billy and Naomi are sort of held up together after Naomi has her US Open in 2020 as these like two pioneering activists who stand up for things and are speaking out and social change, and sort of she's the next Billy in a lot of ways, right? And they're really paired together. But then months later, they find themselves on very opposite sides of this divide, as Billy being very old school when it comes to media and thinking like women's sports, especially, we need the media. We need the attention. We need to work for it. We need to be grateful for this. We need to be accommodating. We need to make the sport be sold. And Naomi did not have that same, that wasn't her thinking, obviously, by boycotting media. She was obviously going out against that, and Billy and her were not on the same page and not on the same frequency. And so, yes, that's an interesting sort of generational divide that gets in that scene.
Kind of there. Venus in the middle as well, because if she loses, quite often she skips press and takes the fine, which is not talked about that much, actually. That's something you kind of have to uncover when you search for the press conference or you try and find out what was said. But she obviously, I mean, we've seen some iconic press conferences from Venus, but in terms of how much she's willing to give at certain times. But I think that is something that's so interesting, is this idea that, you know, because of how much she brings to the game and how big her celebrity is, that like it is a duty for her, you know, put it all out there when it comes to the interviews. But as you say, you can really set the tone. And
hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
That kind of leads me to the activism side of things, because the decision she made seemed like it was a very personal decision. And it seems like a lot of her activism comes from personal experiences where she feels like she has to take an action, or she wants to push back on something or make people aware of something. And obviously that was something that happened after the French Open, happened after the summer, which you said kind of really caught your attention for her and really kind of led to the idea of you doing the book. And I kind of have this thing where people kind of label her as a sort of accidental activist. And I think that from reading your book, it doesn't seem like it's really accidental, like at all. I think her whole shaping of her life has been around, you obviously didn't say that in your book. I mean, like when people talk about her, it's like she's the girl that ended up in activism. When really the whole nature of her experience of moving to the US, being mixed race, she's a Black woman, that experience seems to be what's really brought her into the activism side of things and the injustice that she was seeing, rather than it being kind of accidental that she said something and then people labeled her as that, which I think is a misconception about her, really.
Yeah, no, she grew up, and she talked about this during 2020 US Open. I mean, she grew up in the US, in Florida, actually, at the time of the, I don't know how much, you know, this story's in the book, but it was a huge deal in the US, the Trayvon Martin shooting, and who was a Black boy who was, I don't remember exactly how old, I think he was around 14, and he was killed, not by law enforcement, but someone sort of like an armed person in the US. And it was definitely like racially tinged, and it was a huge, huge tinge, is maybe not the right word there at all. Racially infused, let's say, whatever you want to call it. And it was, yeah. And that was a big clash point. And Naomi was really marked by that. That was a big shift in her memory. That's a really unforgettable moment for her, and was scary for her as a Black kid in Florida herself, like seeing that someone could just kill you for not much reason. And that was her as a teenager. So that was her, you know, that she did express and have Trayvon's name on her mask eventually, the 2020 US Open was organic for her. It wasn't accidental. It'd been sort of her life going there. And people, you know, her father's Haitian, for example, too. And that's always been an undercurrent. And there's a section on that around that US Open chapter as well, where it talks about, you know, Haiti and its history as being a unique history of being slaves overthrowing their captors to form a country in Haiti. And Naomi, and especially in the sort of Black Lives Matter moment or wave of 2020, sort of drawing new strength from that ancestry and new power from that. And that was something she said really motivated her as a Haitian. And Haiti means a lot to her, even if she hadn't spent a ton of time in the country compared to the U.S., certainly, where she lives almost all her life, or Japan, where she grew up as an infant, anywhere where she was born. But those sort of things have power for her. And yeah, so it's not accidental, definitely. And I think that, you know, I think that the 2021 French Open was, all the U.S. Open stuff, I think, got almost entirely praised throughout. Like, that was hugely successful. She won the tournament, made her stands, made her point. We've seen us doing it really elegantly with the masks. It was seen as like a very like effective way to do it.
It was so poignant. It was really impactful.
Yeah. It just got, you know, it sounds crass for activism about Black Lives Matter, but it got kind of rave reviews, right? Everyone was saying this was great. Everyone was praising her. She won Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year. She was one of the several people named it that year. And she was AP Athlete of the Year. Like, she was really on top of the world. And I call it in the book, like, her like imperial period, imperial phase in the book, where she was just, everything she was touching was turning to gold in the public consciousness for that stretch there. And the French Open one did not launch in the same way. I mean, it was clunkier. It wasn't as articulately done, I think, in her original statements. And it got her just off on a strange foot. And I think she miscalculated how it would be received. And if there was a rallying cry that she was trying to start among players about trying to lead a movement, the other players weren't interested. They were not really supportive of what she was doing. And they were honestly, openly, a lot of times mocking her, or saying, well, some were mocking her in private for sure, but also were saying, no, this is not we don't have this issue with press. Like, that's not, we understand press is part of the job and we'll do it. And we're not trying to say that you guys are bad for mental health and kicking us while we're down. Or they did not see Naomi's language and resonate with it.
It also is if you're in a bad place, it can be a bad, like, well, the press can
of
be
course.
A bad place. And if you're not, then it depends on, and she's been so open. So I think so much of it is so important, not just because she raised that issue, but I think the idea of the mental health side of in tennis is now considered so much more in terms of player welfare. And so I think out of that came something really positive, even if kind of
it was
a bit clunky and, you know, it wasn't necessarily the best result. And really, you'd have to say that my perception was that probably her team, if she was feeling on that, she shouldn't have been playing the French Open at the time. She should have probably not put herself.
And look,
in that
was ultimately the decision that got made. She did pull out after one match, but it probably did get too far.
She played pretty well in that first match as well. I remember watching it. And
yeah, she played
like,
okay.
Oh,
she
yeah.
played,
you know,
yeah, it was okay.
We can get to the full round.
She really reacted after she won that match. Like, it was like almost like a tournament win. Like, it was like,
yeah, it was big.
Such a relief, because she knew how much spotlight was on her in that match against Patricia Maria Tsig in the first round of the 2021 French Open. Yeah. But then she pulled out and she just wasn't, you know, I said this at the time, like, she just like wasn't ready for playing a Grand Slam and all that entailed mentally. Like, she just was not ready for that. And so it was the right move for her to withdraw, even though obviously it was unfortunate. But she just, was not in the headspace for it. And that also kind of informed, when I say clunky communication, like, that's very common, you know, when you're not feeling well mentally or dealing with depression or whatever other mental anguish it may be, you're not going to be at your most clear communicating what you need and what you want.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge part of the challenge.
The only problem is that when you have millions of followers, right? And then they will see it, and then it doesn't become something that you can kind of have a chat with someone about and kind of air out. But on that topic of the match at the French Open, I thought we could talk a bit about some of those kind of matches that defined her career. And I'm not saying that that first round match was necessarily one that did it.
It was one of the most watched. It was like, she was in a spotlight. It was interesting because it was like, I think I have this in the book. She was so talked about in like from a media perspective. It was like, what's going to happen? Oh my God, is she going to do the interview? What's going to happen?
Yeah.
But there was like almost no one in the stands. Like, on a fan level, was not an important match, Osaka versus Sig. And it was also during pandemic restrictions and what have you. But it was something, that was sort of a flashpoint, but not actually important to fans or on paper.
Yeah,
or
I mean, I was locked in to see how that would go. I think everyone wanted to see kind of what Osaka would turn up and what would happen after that, especially. But in terms of some of the matches, you know, you talk about some of the key moments, the key matches of a career. I loved seeing that Belinda Bencic as a junior was in there. Obviously, we talked about Sam Stosur, but there have been many big matches. And I was kind of going to ask you, sort of, what are those sort of the matches that in your mind, and obviously a lot of them are in the book, have kind of defined her career? I know from my perspective, the time when I really took note was when she beat defending champion Kerber at the US Open in 2017. It was like 1-3. And I was like, wait, hang on a minute. This shouldn't happen because, you know, Kerber's not known for throwing in 1,000 errors and giving you a win. So that for me was when I was like, oh, this is, I stood and took note that she's going to be a real player to watch. But as the expert, what are those matches that you, it could be for any reason in terms of defining a career, the ones that you particularly enjoyed watching? I know you've talked about that before, but what do matches that stand out to you?
Yeah, I think your Kerber pick is definitely a good pick. That was her first ever winning as any top 10 player. And it came at this moment in the US Open where it was raining. And so she had she was playing under the roof in ash against defending champion. And she was the only match happening on the grounds on day one. I think it was day one, not day two. It was first round, but I think it was day one. And so she had like the entire tournament to herself essentially and pulled out this amazingly resounding beatdown of Kerber 3-1. And Kerber was kind of not having a great year. Kerber had already lost first round of French Open that year. She was up and down, not at most. And she wasn't number one anymore. She'd been number one for some of that year, but really was not comfortable on top of that ladder. And so, yeah, Naomi stepped up and won that match very emphatically. The matches, actually, the way you were framing that question, the ones that I want to highlight, which are different, and I haven't talked about this, so you're getting original content here.
Ooh,
for sure.
Amazing.
It's sort of an early through line. What's in the book, but it's not so, but one of the people I think is sort of, is a good metric for her in those early days is actually Madison Keys. Madison Keys is, she played, I think, a really interesting example of a person who had a similar but different path, who was very much part of the USTA IMG pipeline, was very much someone who was groomed for success and hyped hugely from a very young age and given lots of wild cards and sponsors and has a very sort of interesting divergent path. Also in Florida at the Chris Everett Academy, none of the sort of financial strain that the Osaka family had so much of. Keys was doing that. And so Keys and Naomi play each other for the first time at 2016 US Open. Naomi's leading the match 5-1 in the third set on her way to a huge win. And Keys comes back and Naomi chokes. Keys wins it in a tiebreak. And it's this devastating loss for Naomi from up 5-1 in the third, in the third round of a Grand Slam, which would have been the biggest win of her career by far at that point. And she can't close it out. And she loses to Keys again at Indian Wells the next year in 2017 and loses to her again at, I think, the 2018 French Open. I might be completely right about that, but I think it's something like that.
No,
I don't know if there was one more loss in there. I think it was just 0-3. And then she plays her in the semifinals of the 2018 US Open. And Keys made the final the previous year. Keys has always beaten her. And Naomi steps up, and I think she goes, saves 13 of 13 break points in that match, never broken, and plays amazingly well, summoning this like huge world-beating tennis. And it's just unplayable. And Keys, weeks later in Wuhan, is still talking about it, and it's like, she was too good. Like that, she deserved it. Well, she got asked about it, but
she's like,
still
that match
about
with
it.
Naomi. Like, how was the match you just played? She's like, no, the match I've played before. We've got to talk about it. Yeah,
she was talking about the whole US Open and obviously the final was 3-1 and the controversy that happened there. But that was a real achievement unlocked for Naomi to beat Madison. And I'm actually not sure they've played since. I would have to double check that. But that was a sort of a journey where this person was ahead of her and getting everything. And Naomi sort of scrapped her way and took some L's, but finally shook them off and got this huge win in this moment and played one of the best matches of her life in that 2018 US Open semifinal, which is what made the US Open final the next round possible. So I think Keys, who I go in, you know, a bit of description about her backstory and how it's different than Naomi's, similarities and differences, I think is an interesting comp for Naomi.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very surprising answer. I very much enjoy it. And like a not necessarily a niche head-to-head, but like a head-to-head that we don't think about that much, you know, and the significance of it. And I think there are those players that people have as their whether it's their like nemesis or not, you know, who never really get the win against them. And then when they do, things really shift for them. Or they haven't beaten them in a while and they get a win. And I think that's something where that has such a big impact on how you feel you're playing, because those are the markers that you've played across the years. And kind of on the subject of other matches, obviously Naomi has stepped back onto the court very recently. And so we'd love to talk about her comeback. But you did allude to this at the start when you were mentioning about writing the book. And obviously she did kind of have that not great run of form. And then she took some time off.
Yeah.
Did you always think that she was going to return? Because at that time, you were probably, as you said, you weren't sure if it would be her retirement. Her team weren't always sure if it would be a retirement. But were you surprised by how motivated she was? I mean, she posted her pregnancy announcement at the same time as her comeback announcement, which is quite unorthodox, really.
Yeah, there's actually something that her agent told her not to do. It's like set a date and she's like, I'm doing it. She did it anyway. Said, I'll show you 2024. See you there. Almost exactly a year ago to the day from where we're recording this. It was when she made that announcement. I have to double check the date, but it was in this week during Australian Open, right before Australian Open qualifying started. So it was the same sort of qualies week of Australia where she made her pregnancy announcement. And she pulled out of the tournament one day and they waited maybe 36 hours or 24 hours for her announcement. But she really had been receding from the sport. To what you were saying earlier, yes, she wasn't entering tournaments. She wasn't practicing. She didn't have a coach. Like, was she still a pro tennis player at this point? Like, it was very debatable in her and her team and her, they didn't know, you know, the team, whatever team was left didn't know, you know, they were sort of just like, we'll see. And she didn't know herself either. She didn't have the answers. And it was, this pregnancy news that gave her this clarity and this new sense of purpose and drive. And that has powered her so far, obviously very early in this new comeback, but she's been in a very good headspace and seems very positive and very happy. And we'll see how it goes, but it does seem
it's looking good
right now. It looks really good. And the tennis was really good in Brisbane too. Like the level of the matches she played against Pliskova, especially in that second match, which she lost, but the level was so high, like both like in terms of stats, in terms of just pure peak WTA power tennis. Like that's
it was
a
couple of break points here and there. The fact that I think it was Pliskova took 2 of 2 break points. Naomi had 13 break points. And was it?
It was like 2 of 12. Yeah, now we
yeah,
like 2 for 12
like
or something.
That. Yeah, it was, yeah.
And so yeah, so just a little, and that was the thing that, which is completely normal. Is like when you coming back because in the first match she played Tamara Korpach, she won that, and it was she was really good except when she was trying to serve out the match in the second set, and then she like had a kind of a brain fart.
You can't practice
game
that,
and,
can you?
You can't practice closing and big points, right? That and so that's going to take a little bit more time and practice and trial and error to relearn that skill, but that she'll get there. And, you know, assuming she stays motivated and healthy and as fit as she is, the ball striking has not gotten worse, certainly. It looked almost better than ever, honestly, in Brisbane. It was so good when she was hitting the ball. So I was very impressed by that.
It looked incredible. And something that kind of alludes to some of the things we spoke about earlier as well is this sort of the pressure. And she was almost kind of born and raised with one sole purpose. It wasn't necessarily to be happy, to pursue her education or to pursue kind of the social side of things. It was very much to be a tennis player. And I think at times that's meant that she's had quite a difficult relationship with the love of the game. Kind of with the fact that she has come back and she's put together, she's really staged a fantastic comeback to the tour in terms of her opening event, very early days, but it seems like her attitude has changed by saying that she really enjoyed that, even though she lost it. It was really fun out there, I think she tweeted. And that would be the question that I have is throughout the years, like, does Naomi love tennis? Is it something that she has a change of relationship with? And now this could be the time when she's playing tennis and she loves to play tennis as a tennis player.
I think you used the word relationship and I think it is a kind of a relationship for her. It's not simple. It's a very complex relationship at times and it can have highs and lows, hots and colds, ins and outs, breakups and reunions and all sorts of relationship-y stuff.
Situationship.
And situationships, times where it's hot and heavy, times when they're just friends or taking a break or whatever else you want to say. I think it is that with her in a lot of ways. And I think that she, is currently there and we'll see how it goes, you know, because things are going to come in the future with Naomi and both success and failure have had their challenges they bring with them. You know, both satisfaction and disappointment can be tough to deal with in their own ways. And so Naomi is more experienced now and hopefully will be able to handle things better and in this stage of her life. But
change
it's not gonna be easy.
Right. A change perspective.
Yeah, change perspective for sure. But it's still a really brutal sport. You know, it's still a sport where winning and losing is very black and white. Where
and you lose a lot unless you're really good.
You lose a lot. And that's one of the things that actually in 2021, Naomi got, it's oversimplified, but she got really bad at losing. She started taking losses really hard. And because one of the things also is that she hadn't lost in a very long time because of the pandemic. She went more than a year without losing a match. And she won 2 Grand Slams and played a very partial schedule, but she went more than a year without losing a match. And so when she did start losing again, they became like, it's almost like she was a, a worker, you know, who had hands that like calloused or something that, you know, built up to use the tools, and you don't get, but then when her hands had softened and she got these like cuts and blisters and things started hurting how they didn't used to before when she got out of practice of losing. And so that was something that was, we're watching for in 2022. And also, in,
it was difficult to watch too.
We'll
some
see
of those
how she
scenes.
handles losses. Oh yeah. Completely.
Yeah. At the Australian Open, over I remember they had the tough. Camera behind, behind the scenes after the Anisimova loss, and she played pretty well. Anisimova was pretty inspired that day.
Yeah.
Obviously Naomi's level arguably is much higher, but
that really, it was okay that day, I think.
Yeah.
But that day I
just felt like it was the barometer of how she
certainly the Australian Open, you've seen lots of players come off and start weeping, right? That's a common thing. And like the Australian Open is this bizarre camera thing where, like, I think it was Petra Martic, I want to say it was, who lost to Sloane Stephens and, you know, walks off court, turns the corner, sits down, slumps in the hallway and starts crying after losing this match and being eliminated, totally normal. But the camera like zooms in on her and Sloane was furious afterwards. Sloane is like very much a mama bear figure in the tour, like really protects, wants to protect the girls, as she says, and like doesn't, and sees herself as very much as itch on the player council. I don't know if she does anymore, but she was for a long time. And she definitely sees herself as being sort of like, do not mess with these women. I'm here to protect them.
I guess it can warp your perception of someone based on that moment, which wouldn't normally be seen in that sense. But I think it, hopefully at this stage, it will be a case where her happiness isn't dependent on the results on the court because of the wonderful gift of her daughter. And it won't be so results based, you know, because that's a tough way to deal with life on the tour.
You can hope. Again, you can hope. It's easier said than done. It's easier said than done. But
I'm not a professional tennis player, so
you know what to say.
It's easier to say from here, but very hard to do in practice. But one question that our listeners actually asked us was that about the involvement of Naomi and the Osakas for the book. I think they want to know, like, does Naomi know this book's happening? Have you spoken to people as part of it? And that's kind of the top question we got asked a lot, actually.
Naomi definitely knew about it from the moment I got the deal, or, you know, certainly within hours or days, I don't know exactly how quickly
She was in the room.
Happened. Yeah, no. She was not in the room, but she knew about it the whole way. They were definitely not in the dark about it. Anyone in the family or the team. And actually I mentioned that day in the stoppage in Cincinnati where I first had the idea to write about Naomi. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that at the beginning of the show.
Yep.
And I actually mentioned it in passing to her agent that day. We were talking about like what had been going on behind the scenes of the US Open and the stop, or in New York rather. And I mentioned, I had my notes from that call. I mentioned something about like, I have like going back through his work in the book. I was like, oh, I had the idea this early to actually do the book. And I told him about it that day and it became more serious over time. But yeah, the Osakas were definitely in the loop for sure. And her agent and Naomi in turn from that was responsive, you know, throughout. And he was very good about answering questions and, you know, and Naomi herself as well on the fact checking part of the book at the end was personally engaged and responding and had like a whole like list of stuff that hadn't been published anywhere previously in the book that I hadn't corroborated or wanted her to confirm. And she went through and was sort of like, yes, 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 yes. And then like a couple things were like, well, that's not, and she like clarified a few things like, actually, I went to this place because of that, not because of this, and a couple like things. It showed she was engaged. I really appreciated that from her. You know, it wasn't like unlimited. Yes, we'll do everything you want for this book for sure. There were times where they were definitely a bit arm's length, let's say, about it. But whenever I talked to Naomi while I was working on it in 2022, and certainly at a lot of tournaments, like I said, traveling the tour with her, she was never, as always, she never really had like a guard up. She was never trying to be evasive or cagey, even though she knew I was working on this book. She was always herself and open. And that, you know, was a big help. And I think helped make the book a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure, like, you know, having someone ask you these questions, then they're going to put something together about you, be like kind of fascinated to see like what their take would be. Is it the same as yours?
Yeah.
Kind of things? And maybe that's something that could be interesting. But you did allude to maybe there'll be a part two, or maybe a part two might be done by somebody else. But if it wasn't,
I regret.
It's too soon. You said that. I was like, wait, what? Is there something in the works?
No,
I didn't even have to.
No, definitely nothing. Definitely nothing in the works. I mean, especially with how like in depth this book is. I mean, this book basically covers, you know, I think the book technically chronologically starts at like World War II. you know, when like Russia takes over the islands and kicks Naomi's family off the islands in northeast Japan. And so a lot of time
is covered lesson in this book. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That's my own like nerdiness. I did a couple more of those in the cup, but I kept the World War II one. I just said like the population patterns of Florida or something. That was a whole nerdy tangent that I wound up cutting out. How people migrate to Florida. Anyway, yes, I don't have definitely no immediate plans to do. I think there will be, you know, like in the US, it comes out in hardcover right now. Mm-hmm. The hardcover version of the book, which I'm holding up for everyone listening at home who can't see it. So often there's like, I don't know the plans 100%, but like often there, like Chris Clary's Federal Book just had this actually, where there's a paperback version that came out like a year or so after, maybe his was a couple years after, maybe after the hardcover, and it'll have like an additional chapter on like what happened next. And like, so something like that could happen. I'm not completely taking my eye off what Naomi's doing in 2024. So I'm keeping an eye on that. But I definitely don't think there's going to be, my next book would certainly not be Naomi Osaka 2.
Ooh. Well, if you did have
more voice or more power or whatever, I don't know.
More power, more voice.
More power, more voice. Two power, two voice. Like that.
Exactly. Like where are we at in that equation? But no, in terms of, if there was another player that you would write a book about, who would you write one about? You kind of not necessarily alluded to that, but is there anyone else that you would think would make for a fascinating story from things that you know? Obviously, you haven't had the advanced Googling yet.
Yeah.
But does anyone spring to mind?
Yeah, there's two different factors in that. There's sort of the realistic, there's like who would be the most fascinating person? And I'm obviously a huge tennis nerd. I love lots of like obscure players and quirky players and unique players, interesting players. And there's also like the business side of it, of like who would actually a publisher want to,
I'm not gonna think they could confidently sell a book about necessarily, right?
Right. And so those Venn diagrams don't really overlap a ton in terms of players I find really interesting and players who are, first of all, tennis players who could actually make a book sell about them is a very small circle, bluntly. So that's just not a big circle at all. But some of them, you know, are interesting. So there are certainly names that come to mind. Like I do think, I'm not saying this is my next book, but for answer this question, like I do think there will be many potentially fascinating, very different, potentially like Novak Djokovic books that could come out in the world. I think he's a hugely complicated figure who touches all sorts of different layers of culture, especially when you get into like Serbian history, what it means to Serbia, especially. There's a lot of different like anthropological or, you know, historical ways you could go at telling a Djokovic story and trying to make that appealing for non-Serbian audiences would be the task, obviously. But to make it, I think there's a lot of different ways to do that. So he's the most obvious choice, potentially, I think, in terms of big stars.
If money was no object, you know?
I mean, if money was
like, been funded, you've got a green light for any book or anybody.
Yeah, there's like, you know, there's lots of like quirky player, like, you know, players like, you know, like Barbra Streisand or like Shea Su Wei.
Fascinating.
Shea Su Wei would be amazing,
They've had some great clashes with her and like, Naomi.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I was almost wish I could spend more time waxing lyrically about Shea Su Wei in this book.
We can have you on for another
plenty of stuff in there already
when your second book comes out.
Yeah, but you know, people, someone like Shea Su Wei, I was thinking of her good luck because she retired this week. So her last singles match of her career was this week. Someone like her is a perfect example of someone who would be fascinating, but I don't think would sell. And then this other story, like I just think, you know, I think so many players in tennis, is one of my favorite parts about writing my tennis, especially the way I got to write about it from the New York Times a lot of times, where I was sort of doing the secondary sidebar stories. You know, I was working alongside Chris Clary, as I just mentioned. He would sort of do like the top line, like what are Federer and Nadal doing at the tournament, you know, kind of headline stories. And I would do the sort of, here's something you didn't know about Tanea Bucinski stories. Yeah. And that was Tanea great Bucinski, for me. I love that.
Big fan of her as well. That's a fantastic story.
She's one of my favorite stories I ever did with my interview with her. Yeah. And so like, she would be a great book, honestly.
Yeah, she would be.
And something like that. But so many players have, I'm sure Bucinski is not who people expect me to say. But so many players have those stories, and almost every player on some level has some degree of fascinating story. And that's an exciting thing about the sport, and trying to find ways to connect with them, understand that story and tell it with the world. And it's gotten tougher over the course of my career, for sure. Access is a lot less in terms of media, social media, makes a lot of agents and players think they don't need traditional media so much and they can do their own thing. And I don't really agree with that. I don't think that they get the same value out of just Instagram posts or whatever that you do out of interviews and being sort of profiled and understood in a way that the professional writers can do it. So, I think that's a great answer, Ben, though.
Tamir Baczynski, that's exactly what we're looking for. We were actually at the Billie Jean King Cup and Tamir Baczynski wasn't playing, but we walked past her on the same street as our Airbnb. And I was beyond starstruck because for me, I absolutely love her and her career and the unorthodox nature of it and what she's able to do and like getting the call when she was working in a hotel. And it's just unbelievable when you look at it. And I sometimes double back and read about it again because it's amazing what people can do. And
I did. That was one of my favorite interviews of all time. Was honestly, like, it was a very unique one because if you want me to go on a Baczynski tangent, of course I'm going to do that in the Naomi book.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
Podcast. Yeah. I took the day off of the French Open, which was pretty unheard of for me, to go to like her hotel and like sit in the lobby of her hotel in Paris, or not the day, but like an afternoon off, and like
went a week off.
And she I was like, so tell me what happened, basically. Mm. And she talked for like an hour or so, which is so much longer than the average interview. And I remember actually I was talking to a chair umpire actually who had read the story. I'm not gonna say it was chair umpire, but a WTA chair umpire who had read the story and was talking to Baczynski like at like the airport, like somewhere a few weeks later, and was like, I read this article, you know, or it was amazing. And she was like, yeah, like Ben like asked me a question. I don't know what it was, but I just like started saying everything, all these things I never said before. It was like this like really like therapeutic moment for her, which obviously I'm not a therapist, but like something about whatever was going on in her mind or the setting or something like made it the right person, the right moment, the right time.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite stories, the sort of first Baczynski story. And that story could have been a book or at least a long magazine article at the time from that interview. It
might absolutely
be like a 1200 word newspaper story, which is still long, but it was, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there. And definitely that's the kind of thing. I always find it really interesting. This goes back to Naomi currently too. Baczynski fit kind of my strategy for writing stories at that time in my career, and I still have the strategy. It's almost always more interesting to talk to people who spent a time away from tennis. People who've just been on the hamster wheel nonstop often don't have the perspective or other experiences or challenges or whatever.
You need some life stuff as well.
People who've been away, people who've had adversity and a reason to leave, a reason to come back, they're often the people I find most compelling. So
Emma Raducanu could be that person.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear about like Raducanu's. Raducanu's like time in China. I want to hear about.
She was definitely upskilling and living life, and that was incredible to see. So we're slightly running short on time, but I've got some questions for you where we can do some one word answers of predictions. I think on the tennis podcast, our least favorite word is predictions, but we seem to do quite a lot of them, and they always go wrong. So don't worry, we won't hold the. We might hold them you to this if you do well, but if you don't, we won't bring it up again.
Okay.
So in terms of some predictions for the year, who do you think is going to have a standout year this year of players? Is there one player that you're watching thinking this could be a big year for them?
It is such a lazy answer to say Naomi, but honestly,
we can say
that's
Naomi for all
my
of them.
Data. From,
yeah.
I'm going to say, no. I was going to say Naomi. Naomi is what I said. Like Naomi Osaka, I think it's going to be, I don't know if you heard about her, but she is, Naomi Osaka.
Naomi Osaka.
Yeah, I think she's going to have a really good year. I think that she is looking sharp. And honestly, like, I think that that's obviously me being biased, but I do think that she's like a pick that makes sense on paper also with how well she played in that part of the year. And she's one of the things I would definitely like be buying Osaka stock in terms of her current ranking to go up in terms of that. Because her current ranking is also like in the 700s or something. Yeah. So yeah, I definitely think that she is someone I'm looking at for sure. I am very, very impressed by Iga Świątek. I think that she's much better than everyone else right now in tennis. I think the rankings don't do justice how much better she is in my mind. She's just like so far and away from even the rest of the top five. And maybe if Sabalenka doesn't defend her Australian Open title, maybe the rankings will reflect that a bit more. Because Sabalenka is obviously pretty close, but has 2,000 points about to come off. So we'll see how that goes. And if Sabalenka obviously wins another Australian Open, then she would really reassert herself. So that would change the narrative around that in my mind and in the world. But I think very, very highly of Iga. I think she's if she has another good year and like wins, say, two slams and stays number one, I think this will kind of officially be like the Świątek era of the sport in WTA history, in a way that has not quite felt like she's really completely consolidated power that way, but she's close. I think she's close. And I would love to see her play the aforementioned Naomi and have them get a real rivalry, some kind of rivalry again would be great.
Well, they have history, tennis, don't they, as well, in terms of the support they've had and shared between each other.
Yeah, they're buddies. Yeah.
Yeah, that's been super nice. I think I did like a...
They're very different, but they're
an engaging
buddies,
Zoom call.
Or they're similar and different.
Yeah, it was a very different one. But in terms of Australian Open, I'm going to ask for one name for men and women that you think is going to take the title.
I will say Djokovic, which is so boring, but it's idiotic not to say that.
Okay, I went for Sinner, but okay, I'll take that.
Okay, that's good. And that,
I was like, I've
got to
do something different this time.
I've been to so many Australian Opens, and Djokovic has won almost all of them. So
yeah,
that's my experience.
The stats
Djokovic.
Say that, yes.
Yeah. And then the women, I'll say Świątek. I think that she is, this is again, really safe, not adventurous number one picks, but I really like her game. I think she played well in United Cup. I think she's going to be a player to beat, and we'll see how conditions are. We'll see how things go. I mean, she did get pretty handled by Rybakina last year, and even by Collins year before that. So if she plays a big hitter in these conditions, it can be trouble for her. And even like Ostapenko beat her at the US Open that way.
Yeah.
But with the right draw, I think she can be the player to beat.
For year-end number ones, I'm guessing you know Djokovic and Świątek then, based on your answers. Is that what you think for the end of 2024?
I think Świątek for sure. For the men, it's going to depend on... At some point, Novak Djokovic is going to get old and slow down.
No,
it's going to happen
that's
biologically
impossible.
At some point.
I don't think he's human.
It's going to happen at some point. Yeah. No, it's going to happen
he's
at some point.
He's been replacing the parts.
Yeah, exactly. It's that, you know, Theseus ship kind of thing. So, yeah, I think he's still my pick. I think he's comfortably better than everybody. And yes, I would love to see it be more interesting than that in terms of competitively and have some surprises. But I think that Djokovic is still the best. And I think he showed that in Turin when, you know, Sinner let him off the hook and he immediately pounced.
Exactly. He's a force to be reckoned with whenever he steps onto the tennis court. The money is always on betting for him when it comes to that. And our final question, which we ask all of our listeners, we are a British podcast, in case you hadn't realized, Ben, I'm from the UK, believe it or not. I know that I do have a bit of an accent now, but we always ask our guests how they take their tea.
Oh my, I think I take my tea infrequently, but happily when it comes along with, my mom makes tea more than this. It's usually when I'm with my mom. Mom's tea with honey and lemon is usually a situation for her.
Okay.
Yeah. Not very British, I don't guess, but yeah.
There's no tea bag involved there. So like you might have lost a few supporters, but I do think that everyone is happy.
Oh no, you make the tea and you make the
tea.
Oh, got
it. I thought it was honey and lemon. Oh, got it.
It's not just water. No, it's not just water. And there is tea.
Okay.
Tea was implied. Sorry.
It's like fruity water.
The tea is like in a pot and you brew the tea and then you pour it.
Oh, that would be very nice. Like good when you're sick, definitely. Yeah. You know, that's a real
It's like
winter warmer.
I had it like in recent winter months. My most recent tea was when I was home during winter and maybe feeling not sniffly or whatever, but potentially just, you know, groggy from winter. And so that was
the remedy. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for that insight at the end, Ben. So
for sure.
It's been fantastic having you on. And listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Ben's book, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice, is out now and available to purchase from all good booksellers and online. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action from the ATP and WTA tours. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also follow us on social media and make sure that you follow Ben on social media, with his Twitter handle being Ben Rothenberg. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X. And our handle is Tennis Weekly Pod. You can email the show. Ben, feel free to email us at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com. Or you can check out our website. I wouldn't check out our website, Ben. We need to update it a little bit probably. But that's tennisweekly.co.uk. And we will be back very soon with our Australian Open coverage. So I hope that you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's such a big thank you to Ben. Thanks for having us. Thanks for joining us. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me. This is great.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.